Thank you. faculties of the park is, of course, its need of energy. You have to have inexhaustible supplies of energy. And the great danger that I was always aware of was that one might exhaust oneself in the first scene and then not have enough to go on for the rest. Terrible danger. In fact, at our opening performance, I rather think I blew my top a little bit too much in the scene with Goneril, because it left me gasping in the subsequent scenes. However, since then, we've reformed that altogether, I hope, as Hamlet says.
What is the physical problem? How intense is the physical problem? When you come in at the end, carrying Cordelia, this requires physical effort in itself.
Yes, it does.
Doesn't it? You have to carry the body of the girl in and at the same time speak and at the same time indicate Lear's broken heart. And I would think that there's a problem there of just lifting the girl and carrying her and speaking at the same time.
Well, it would be ungallant of me to say that there was a problem of lifting the girl. However, she weighs about 110 pounds. She's kept herself down nicely, but by the end of the evening, she weighs about 150. But, the fundamental point you touch on there is, I think, has to do with the situation. When an actor is involved in the circumstances of any scene, there is something about the circumstances which strengthen him, which give him fortitude, so that he can literally move mountains, perhaps not as a chronic practice, but for a moment, he is capable of doing more than he thought he was capable of doing.
Well, I think in that particular case, if you suggested as a human being that you were having a little difficulty lifting those 110 pounds, we would suddenly forget about Lear and worry about you as a person carrying 110 pounds.
You're quite right. It's possible to say that you don't believe a Lear who is supposed to be fourscore and upward, as he says. You can't possibly believe that a man as old as that and who's been through the tribulations that he has would be capable even of an act of prowess like carrying his daughter in. But one must not hint at his weakness. It seems to me one must drive and play from his strength. He is a colossus. This involves physical strength to the very end. As a matter of fact, a point that arises out of that, and I know one that will interest you, is the following. I think Lear chooses to die when he dies. I think that at the beginning of the play finds him in a psychological condition which says, I know I am old, I know that it's time to give up my power, and all my life I've been accustomed to wield enormous dictatorial power. In fact, all my courtiers have told me, as he says in the play, that I was everything. And one of the pathetic lines is, 'tis a lie, I'm not ague-proof, says he. Well, he finds out that he's not a lot of things. And the act of resigning his rule in the very first scene leaves him in the position of a scholar of life, someone who's going to find out for the first time what life really is, what the fundamental qualities and values of life are. Love, for example, something which he had perhaps not even given very much thought, but taken for granted. He finds immediately in the first scene that his elder two daughters give him all the love he wants in words, while the one who really loves him restrains her articulation, so to speak. And from then on begins the education of Lear. So that, and he does this willingly, being a tragic hero, he challenges fate. I think this is the dominant quality of all tragic heroes. In one way or another, they challenge destiny. They say, do your utmost. I will maintain my point of view and my character and my will to survive. He says again and again such things as, pour on, I will endure. At the end, when he realizes that Cordelia is dead and that the only thing in life worth having is gone, is denied him forever, he resigns his life. He gives up. He says, you can have it. And it's a rather poor trick you've played on me, you face. He never accuses God, but he turns to the gods. Shakespeare makes that clear.
I have an idea that one part of the play that's fascinating, and it seemed to me that this is something that's in your performance, and that is this, that despite the fact that he's very old and keeps mentioning the fact that he is very old and indicates in some ways his age, in the foolish way he behaves in the beginning, that he has to have at the same time enormous physical strength. You said energy. Maybe that's a better word, energy, because there's tremendous energy in his feelings.
That's
in
right.
His passions.
That's right.
In his expression of passions. Now,
that's
this
right.
Has to come from something physical. It's part mental, but it's part physical, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes. I knew an old actress, Madame Adler, in New York, who once said to me, I asked her something along these lines, how is it that you do the parts you do still? She was quite old. And she said, God bless me, I have energy. And she did, even at her age. Now, I think Lear is that kind of a person. I think as long as we maintain our passion for living, so long do we retain our energies.
And passion is the word for it, too, because his emotions have been lifted up to that particular point. When he feels anger, it isn't just ordinary anger. You use the word colossus. It's colossal anger. It's anger carried up to the highest possible pitch, wouldn't you say so?
Absolutely.
And his hatred is carried to a tremendous pitch.
Yes.
And this seems to me to be the result of something in him that is a tremendous force that drives him up to those peaks of feeling. But in order to sustain those peaks of feeling, even though he breaks from one thought to another, as he does in the denunciation of Goneril, when he says, I will do such things, and then breaks down like a very old man and says, I know not yet what they
exactly.
are, which is a terribly heartbreaking
very.
Thing, I think. But there is an inward, a colossal inward strike that carries him up, and this is one of the most moving things about it. This is a gigantic figure inside, don't you think so?
Yes. It comes from, you've already characterized it, but there's a desire to penetrate in Lear, which you will find in perhaps the great scientists who will not give up until they have penetrated the secret of whatever they're after. Whether Lear knows it at the beginning or not, he is impelled by this desire to find out the ultimate. And to me, this is one of the mysteries of Lear. As a matter of fact, that first, the first few moments of King Lear are, to me, veiled in a kind of mystery. He speaks about, meantime, we shall express our darker purpose. Now, these are words which can be taken as, well, he simply wants to explain to the court that he's divided his kingdom in the way that he has intended all along. To me, it means something more. You see, when you consider Shakespeare's identity as a poet, as well as a dramatist, then the suggestiveness of the words of a play like Lear become multiplied manyfold. That's why I am personally fascinated by such a phrase as our darker purpose. It doesn't mean just something literal. I'm also fascinated by such things as Child Roland to the Dark Tower came. That's a kind of poet's way of saying we face the ultimate in this play. We challenge the absolute in fate, and we take the consequences. That's what this play is about. And this is why we speak of Lear as a colossus, but you know, so is Gloucester in his way. Mm-hmm. Not quite as much as Lear, but so is he. So in a way are the daughters. Edmund, all these characters are great splinters from Shakespeare's colossal imagination, working as it was at this time in molten heat.
I think that that's true. I think that the word intensity is the one that seems to me to be perhaps most important in this. The idea that the passions are carried up to the highest level. I think we all feel all the emotions that Lear feels. We felt them and we've been carried away by them, but we're carried away a little bit. Lear is carried up to a point where he's almost on a mountain peak alone. But you recognize him as a human being who's gone there on our feelings. You think that's this?
Very true. As a matter of fact, this is borne out by the response of the audience and also by responses that I find in letters that I receive. People are involved. They identify with this man, this great, great man. He is a genius in his way, this Lear. And I think one of the reasons for this is the age we live in. I think there's no time in my own life that I can remember when Lear was more worth doing and said as much, said more to an audience than it does today. There's a kind of ultimate challenge in our life. Here we are at the brink, and we've been sitting at the brink for so many years, and we all know it, and we live our lives in a kind of a constant awareness of danger. How long are we going to keep this off, this dreadful catastrophe which has been promised us in a way by fate? Well, this is the kind of age in which we can understand the ultimate aspect of a character like Lear. If you think only of the aspect of the challenges that evil poses to good, you can't get much further down than good and evil.
No.
And this is a play about that, among other things.
And where the rest of us sit and hold back and wait, Lear, according to your interpretation, accepts and faces the challenge.
That's right.
And in the storm scene, faces it stripped down. Literally strips off his clothes, doesn't he?
Yes. There's a curious pleasure. It's a strange thing. It's a sort of identification with the elements to which he seems to be saying, as I said before, pour on, I will endure, I'll take everything you have to give me and I'll come through. In a strange way, which is typical of tragedies, he does come through. Mm. In a strange way, he beats the storm.
And then he stands for us, don't you think?
Yes.
And he says, all right, it's a tremendous thing you're doing to me. It's a terrible, unjust thing. Okay, do your worst. And strips off his clothes and says, I'll take it as what? Unaccommodated man?
Yes. If I have to realize that every person, including myself, is unaccommodated man, this poor, bare, forked animal that we all are, then I'm up to that too. I spoke before about the education of Shakespeare. That's part of it. I meant the education of Lear. That's part of it. In the so-called utterly mad scene where he comes in decked with flowers and so on, Lear begins to give forth the products of some of his thinking, mad though it is, and his madness has the frightening quality of dead white sanity, because now he begins to look at society and at various aspects of man and woman, and he says, let's face it. If I'm facing up to myself, Let all men, all women face up to themselves too. Let justice face up to itself. Let cruelty, let punishment, let all these things face up to themselves. Let them realize their fundamental horror, and at the same time he says, no one is to be blamed. None, he says, none is blameworthy.
I think that the great tragedies, the great plays, all begin with a character who is basically human, like us. We understand it because we have the same feelings that he has. But he goes beyond us. He goes a step beyond. And when Lear strips himself down and says, blow on to the storm, I'll face it, and then this is the point at which he becomes an awesome figure. Do you think that that makes sense?
Certainly
it
does.
Arthur Miller once said something about the heroes of tragedy carrying our sins almost in a sack on their back. And
that's
we
right.
See them go, and we're appalled because that's us there. But they go a step beyond us.
Lear says in a more beautiful moment in the play, perhaps, to Cordelia, he says, upon such sacrifices, my Cordelia, the gods themselves throw incense. Now there is in this an acceptance of what you just said, of the fact that, yes, we creatures who are capable of bearing more, must bear to the utmost, because this is our function, this is our destiny.
They seem to me to represent, and he more than any other character, the weakness and the humanity and the puzzlement of humanity, but with the heroic quality, I will go forward beyond what other men have dared. I will dare to carry the burden, and I'll go so far that I'll find out what the ultimate truth is. You spoke about the educational Lear. Isn't this what he's reaching for? He's driving ahead further. The rest of us shut our eyes.
Yes.
Because we're frightened of the
this
ultimate discovery.
This is what
discovery.
I feel of him, even in the very first scene. That's why, to me, there's a kind of mystery about his first appearance.
Yeah.
Because I think we must say that Lear is no melodramatic actor, you know. He doesn't say, I will challenge God because that's the function of a great hero. No. He goes to the sacrifice, in a sense, humbly. He says, I'm not to blame. I acted out of generosity, out of love, out of manhood. Therefore, what is this that's happening to me? The universe is crashing in on my head. In that case, let me find out humbly, to the end, what it is that the gods intend for me. But I don't think he does this consciously. He does it unconsciously. And this is, by the way, his lovable quality.
Mm. Well, I think he develops consciousness as he goes in. I think in that scene on the heath, you remember he says, I have given too little thought to these things.
Yes.
He says to them, leave me alone a little while. I'm going to pray.
Mm-hmm.
And then he says, what is that about poor, unaccommodated wretches?
No, poor naked wretches, wheresoever you are, that bide the pelting of this pitiless storm.
Yeah.
And he says, how shall your unfed sides and houseless heads, how shall you survive?
Yes.
Such seasons such as these, I'm paraphrasing.
Mm.
And then he says, in a sudden realization, oh, I have attained too little care of this.
Mm, that's the beginning of his education, the beginning of recognition.
That's one of the signs, yes.
I have taken too little care of this.
Yes.
Isn't that the line?
That's the line.
From that point on, his mind is beginning to open up to the fact that he has done things wrong, at least in a negative sense. He hasn't recognized the suffering of humanity.
That's right, of humanity at large. Socially, you might say, he has not recognized it. Earlier, we've had a hint from him that he recognizes the suffering of his fellow sufferer, namely the fool, when he embraces him and asks, are you cold? I'm cold myself. And poor, I have one part in my heart that's sorry yet for thee, says he to the fool. This is personal recognition of suffering. But now he recognizes it in a larger, more social way.
Then he begins to become the universal figure.
Right.
And the gigantic figure when
That's
he begins
right.
to understand.
That's right.
And then he begins to go on from there to further recognition. But
right.
he has the courage to go on.
Mm-hmm. He achieves imagination. Mm. I think that the great thinkers and understanders of our human predicament have imagination. Not only knowledge, but imagination.
But do you think Lear had it in the beginning? I don't think he had it until the storm.
That's right.
Then his mind begins to open up and these things begin to
That's
come
right.
to him.
It took the cataclysm.
As an actor, which of those scenes is the most difficult to play, would you say?
I would say offhand that physically, just from the point of view of sheer physical energy, the storm scene, beginning with blow winds and crack your cheeks, and continuing right on through to the end of our first act, which is the entrance into the hovel, I would say that requires immense energy from the actor, but physical energy. But later, there are scenes which require a curious concentration, which is very, very difficult. One of them is the awakening scene. Another, of course, is the mad scene with Gloucester, where the concentration is quite big.
And he's ultimately crazy and lucid. From one sentence to the
That's
next,
right.
saying
yes.
pertinent things and, mm-hmm. and ridiculous things.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you what, one of the things, of course, I think many scenes in this performance are most extraordinary. One of those which seemed to me to be most, the best of all, the most revealing, I would think would be difficult, is you spoke about the awakening. When Lear awakens and sees Cordelia, and when he finally begins to recognize this, says, if you have poison for me, give it to me. The reason I thought that this was particularly impressive is, first of all, because it seems true, and second, because it seemed to me to keep some of Lear's intensity, if you'll excuse me for hanging on to that word, and another thing, because of the fact that you were able to play it in a low key, vocally, and yet to project the man's feeling.
Mm-hmm.
When you're on the heath in the mad scenes, you can shout, and you
yes.
have to shout.
Yes.
But here the feelings are no less intense, but the voice has to be much lower.
Mm-hmm.
And yet the voice filled the theater.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just as poignant at that particular moment.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll tell you a secret of the actor apropos of this, and that is, when the actor is truly concentrated, intense, to use that word,
mm-hmm.
and is aware of his intention, mm-hmm. his action, he never has any difficulty being heard and of penetrating to the last seat in the theater. Rarely does he have difficulty. It's in such a frame of reference that the emotions become liberated, and when that happens, you can hear.
Mm.
They fly. The words
well,
fly.
Well, I think you are being very modest about it. I think this is a great achievement to be able to make. It isn't just hearing the voice, it's feeling the man's inside at that particular time,
mm-hmm.
as intensely as you feel when Lear is shouting at the top of his lungs. Thanks very much. We have to stop here.
Right.
Good night.
Oh, you didn't
want
to do it.
Good night.
Well, that seems for sure. William Schumann, president of Lincoln Center and one of America's foremost composers, was the winner of the first Pulitzer Prize ever given in music. He is a prolific composer whose output includes concertos, ballets, choral works, chamber music, a baseball opera, The Mighty Casey, and eight symphonies. Dr. Schumann is also a distinguished educator and administrator. After serving 17 years as president of the Juilliard School of Music, in 1962 he accepted the invitation to become president of Lincoln Center for the Performing Arts, the position he now holds.
Whenever I'm introduced to a new group of people, I can count on one observation and one question, never failing. There's always a joke, because my name is Schumann with one N. I've learned how to feel that one. And then there's always the comment, how do you equate your life as an administrator with your life as a composer? And how is it that you are a composer and also as an administrator? Who was it? Did anyone send down a message from on above which said that an administrator was not to be a creative person? Or that a creative person was not to be an administrator? Did anybody say how this thing should work? It seems to me that it's got to work differently for every person. And I can't think of my work as a composer or as an educator, teacher, or school administrator, or the chief executive officer of Lincoln Center as anything except part of a single life. It's all one thing. No one has ever suggested to me that I'm a very good administrator in the abstract. I haven't been invited to run a laundry or a department store or an insurance company. My life as an administrator stems from my interest in the art of music and in all the other performing arts. We're a New York family. We've always lived in the city or in the suburbs. I was born on the west side of New York City. When I was very young, we moved for a few years to Englewood, New Jersey, then came back to the city, then Far Rockaway for a short time. That was the beginning of my great interest in baseball, playing a lot of baseball down there. And the first interest that I suspected in myself, as I look at it now in retrospect, of the entrepreneur. I remember I was in the shoe-shining business, and I also remember that I was in the business selling Peek's candies. One of my best customers was my father. We then moved back to New York, and I wanted to study violin. I went to George Washington High School, but I formed a jazz band, and I played the violin, conducted the orchestra, and sang. It was called Billy Schumann and his Alamo Society Orchestra. Then I became interested through my own band in popular music, and at Camp Cobbessey, where I was first, where I was a camper for many years, I began in 1922, and I loved camp, not the way most people love camp. I loved camp with an absolute all-out passion. You know, when I won the All-Around Campus Cup, this is to me like someone else being given the Congressional Medal. I matriculated at New York University because I fancied that I might want a career in business, or at least in advertising. But after a year or so of that, I decided this wasn't for me. I remember distinctly leaving NYU, walking all the way from Washington Square and getting as far as 76th or 78th Street, wherever it was. There was the Malkin Conservatory of Music, and I went in the door, told them I wanted to become a composer. When those songs were published from Camp Cobbessey, I didn't know how to put down even the lead sheet, even the melody line. And when I heard them, the harmonies were all wrong. And since I didn't play piano, I did all these things mentally. I did my first arrangements by spreading pieces of paper all over the living room in my house and making up all the parts one by one out of my head
and writing them down in light blue ink on individual parts. Then I took my arrangements to the Hotel Biltmore, where Bert Lown was playing. I had met Lown by then because he agreed to publicize the first song that I had published, which is called Lovesick. And his picture was on the cover, and he shared in the royalties, which means he too didn't get anything. Lovesick went, Lovesick, I need your kiss to make me well again, etc. A beautiful ballad. Of course, our apartment actually is our home. There is a library which serves as my studio. And I'm afraid it has a very active telephone in it because many, many hours in that library are spent on the telephone with Lincoln Center and with Lincoln Center directors and executives. I try to do a little writing in that room, but I've done precious little. I haven't worked out my schedule yet at Lincoln Center so that I can write very much during the winter. And so we put up a small place in Connecticut where we can be in the summer with our family, and of course where I can compose, and where we have the leisure really to enjoy our friends even more than we do during wintertime. And our friends really come from all walks of life, naturally including composers, Aaron Copland, a dear friend of long standing, and same course of Morton Gould. Anthony Struco helps me as music editor. Vera Maxwell, a designer. Carl Maidens, a photographer. Claire Reese, who is the founder of the League of Composers. And close professional associates have often become very close friends. I think back on the Juilliard days, there was Mark Schubart, who was Dean of Juilliard and is now with me at Lincoln Center as the head of our educational program. Norman Lloyd, who was an important figure at Juilliard and now is the head of the arts program with the Rockefeller Foundation. And James P. Warburg, who was chairman of the board of the Juilliard School when I went there. James Warburg called me on behalf of the Juilliard board. I'd been teaching music at Sarah Lawrence College. I think I'd been there for about 10 years. I told him I didn't want to be a candidate for the position of president at Juilliard. While I very much respected the faculty at the Juilliard, that is to say the instrumental faculty, I really did not respect the way composition was taught, and especially the way music theory was taught. And I didn't believe in it, that was all. And he said to me, well, don't be so tough. Why don't you come down and talk with a boy?
When I inherited this job of being a director of the Juilliard School from my father, I found myself associated with seven lawyers who were the heirs of Mr. Juilliard or the executive or something.
That art has a far deeper meaning than mere delight, than mere entertainment. It is a transforming experience. Not the lie of self-deception, nor the lie of self-aggrandizement.
thoughts give us hope. They tell us clearly that stronger than the forces that separate men are the forces that bring them together. When I was in North Carolina this spring, I had a marvelous stay with a group of wonderful students down there who put on a festival of the arts, and they had many people come to Chapel Hill for the occasion. And during the course of the festival, they gave an evening of my music, and I was talking with some of the students and talking about the general subject of labels and saying that, you know, in 1936 or 7, whatever it was, in my Second Symphony was played in Boston. It was hissed. It was considered a far-out radical piece. And then later on, I guess I was considered to be a more conservative, and then a middle-of-the-roader. And I suppose my ambition, I said to this group of students, should be to be considered reactionary before I'm dead. And one of the students said to me, you know, maybe you've already made it. And because I don't think really that labels have anything to do with merit and composition, nor do I think that they are revelatory of very much. I think it's possible to have an exceedingly interesting and forward-looking work written in a very conservative idiom. And to me, this is quite clear. I think if you don't have composers that are trying always to create new sounds and new approaches and new aesthetic doctrines, then you will have an art that dies. But it isn't the newness of the aesthetic doctrine, I think. Certainly not the newness of the form, not the newness of the sounds that makes for communication. It's what the man has to say as a person. If he happens to be a creative giant and not only has something to say, but has new ways and new techniques and new directions to say it, well, this produces the great figures of the field of music and the other arts as well. But it doesn't mean that the many splendid artists who are fine creators and who do not necessarily blaze all the trails are any less valuable to the human race. At least these are my views. I think the trick is that an artist must be true to himself. And I say without shame or hesitation that I think this is a moral issue as well as an aesthetic issue. Perhaps it's even more a moral issue. The trick is to be what you are. That, to me, is the whole trick. And if you can continue always to function, whether it's writing music or doing anything else, in terms of the things that you believe in, then at least you're being genuine. And I know no other road to happiness.
This life.
I'm